It's Tuesday, June 25, 2013. I'm Albert Moeller, and this is The Briefing, a daily analysis of news and events from a Christian worldview. One of the chief symptoms of the moral confusion of our age is a deep confusion over what previous generations of humans hardly ever were confused about. That is the issue of gender. The very use of the word gender is something that is relatively new. Previously, human beings were described in English as being separated into two sexes, male and female. The very use of the word gender, which is now nearly unavoidable, implies that the differences are somewhat, if not greatly, a matter of social construction and mere language. Of course, the Christian worldview affirms the fact that gender, that is, the fact that human beings are made male and female, is a matter of the goodness of God's creation. God intended for His glory to be reflected in the differences between men and women and in the need of the one for the other. Also, human flourishing is found where the distinctions that God has made and has affirmed as being of utmost importance are honored rather than confused. That's what makes a major news story this week out of Colorado not only confusing but deeply concerning. Some months ago, we talked about little Coy Mathis, the elementary school child, born a boy but living as a girl, who was in the midst of a controversy in Colorado because his local school district ruled that he, having the physical makeup of a boy, could not use the girls' restroom in his elementary school. Now, as the Washington Post reports, Colorado officials say that Coy Mathis was discriminated against as a six-year-old transgender girl when the Colorado Springs School District prevented her, as she is identified in this article, from using the girls' restroom in what advocates described as the first such ruling in the next frontier in civil rights, end quote. Now, before looking at the specifics of the case, let's just ponder for a moment what it means for the Washington Post to report that a six-year-old child, born a boy but now living as a girl, is at the center of what they describe as the next frontier in civil rights. As the Post goes on to report, Coy Mathis's family raised the issue after school officials at Eagleside Elementary in Fountain, Colorado, said the first grader could use restrooms in either the teacher's lounge or in the nurse's office, but not in the girl's bathroom. Coy's parents, according to this article, feared that Coy would be stigmatized and bullied. On Monday of this week, the Mathis family and its lawyers celebrated the ruling on the steps of the state capitol, according to the Post. Coy, described by the paper as, quote, dressed in a glittering tank top, jeans, and pink canvas sneakers, ran around a, quote, towering blue spruce tree as her mother spoke to reporters. Her mother said this, and I quote, her future will be better if we get to this place where this is nothing to be ashamed of, end quote. Of course, here you have the mother of a six-year-old child, born as a boy, but now living as a girl, described by the Washington Post as running around in a glittering tank top, jeans, and pink canvas sneakers, as being in a happier place, free of bullying and discrimination, because this child is now, according to the Colorado Division of Civil Rights, able to use the first-grade girls' restroom. As the Associated Press reports, the gay rights movement has won mounting legal and electoral victories in recent years, and its advocates hope that this latest decision, that is, this week's decision by the Colorado Division of Civil Rights on behalf of Coy Mathis, will lend momentum to the struggles of transgendered people. Michael Silverman is the attorney for the Mathis family. He said, quote, this is by far the high watermark of cases dealing with the rights of transgendered people to access bathrooms. According to the Associated Press, the Maine Supreme Court is now considering the case of a 15-year-old girl who was forbidden from using her school's girls' bathroom. But this is a 15-year-old transgendered girl who still has the physical characteristics of the boy, which is the gender the child was born. As the Washington Post describes the situation of Coy Mathis, he was born a triplet with two sisters, and he identified as a girl before the child began attending elementary school. Her father, Jeremy, is an ex-Marine. At 5 months of age, according to the Post, she took a pink blanket meant for her sister, Lily. Later, she showed little interest in toy cars and boy clothes with pictures of sports, monsters, and dinosaurs on them. The child insisted on wearing girls' rather than boys' clothes. After the parents accepted Coy wanting to be a girl rather than a boy, according to the Washington Post, quote, Coy came out of her shell, end quote. At this point, the Washington Post coverage reaches a very interesting point. According to the paper, Coy was diagnosed with what was known as gender identity disorder, that's in quotation marks, an official diagnosis then recognized by the American Psychiatric Association. However, now that is no longer a recognized ailment. As the Post reports, the APA removed that category last year from its list of mental ailments. The paper says the removal reflected the growing medical consensus that identification as another gender cannot be changed. That situation related to the American Psychiatric Association explains why there is so much confusion about this, but it also explains why the confusion is now so bureaucratically recognized. In other words, we are institutionalizing the confusion. Recall that back during the early 1970s, the American Psychiatric Association, followed then by the American Psychological Association, took a vote in their respective conventions, deciding that homosexuality is not a mental ailment. It had been identified as such by both of these psychiatric and psychological groups, and yet under political pressure, acknowledged by the leadership of both groups, the groups decided to change homosexuality as an orientation, as a sex preference, and as an activity from being a mental illness to being perfectly normal. Now, as the Washington Post indicates, just a year ago, Coy Mathis was identified with a diagnosis of having a mental ailment of gender confusion. But just a year ago, the American Psychiatric Association took that particular ailment out of its diagnostic list. What does that tell you about the practice of psychiatry? What does it tell you about the confusion that is brought when the therapeutic categories begin to reign in a culture? When psychologists and psychiatrists hold a vote in which in one year something's an ailment and the next year it's not, this is supposed to now influence the very direction of our culture. And sadly enough, clearly it is. In response to the decision in Colorado, Matt Staver of Liberty Counsel pointed out that school administrators are now put in a no-win situation. They're put in an impossible moral and legal context where they now have to take the word of a 6-year-old or of a 6-year-old's parents, or for that matter of a 15-year-old or perhaps the 15-year-old's parents, as to what gender or sex the child is supposed to be recognized as to be. We're talking here about a deep confusion. It's difficult even to report on this program because the pronouns used in the mainstream media of Coy Mathis are uniformly she and her, recognizing the legitimacy of the transgendered context. It's hard for someone who rejects that worldview even to know at this point what pronouns to use in describing a situation. Christians looking at this must recognize that Coy Mathis, regardless of the confusion that now affects the child and his parents and so many others, was born a boy and actually remains a boy, a deeply confused boy nonetheless, with confusion that is being aided and abetted, undoubtedly compounded by the adults in his life. As Staver points out, school districts are now going to be in the position, according to the decision handed down in Colorado and now pending also in Massachusetts and Maine, to accept whatever a child, a student, whether the child is a elementary school student or a teenager in high school, says is his or her gender, regardless of what the biological construction is. In other words, you could have a 15 or 16-year-old boy, at least physiologically a boy, demanding to be considered a girl, and according to this decision, able to use a girl's bathroom, and beyond that, also the girl's locker room. As Staver points out, it will not be long until it is virtually impossible for school districts to know who is actually speaking the truth about claiming to be transgendered and who is actually just gaming the system. This is a very difficult situation that is further compounded by the fact that the schools, according to at least some judgments and theories, will have to recognize what the child says at a current age, even if it runs into direct conflict with what the parents want the child to be and to be recognized as being. Even though the revolution on the issue of homosexuality is vast and its consequences are incalculable, the actual moral transformation on the transgendered agenda is far beyond even homosexuality. It leads to a deep confusion about the very essence of gender and sex, what it means to be male and female, and asserts within our common cultural conversation a deep uncertainty about that which human beings must be certain, at least at some level, to have a workable and sustainable community. One of the most ominous statements in the Washington Post article on this issue doesn't come from Colorado at all. It comes from the United States Vice President Joe Biden, who last year described transgender rights as, and I quote, the civil rights issue of our time, end quote. If so, and he may well be right, as this signal from Colorado should indicate, we are living indeed in not only deeply confused times, but deeply dangerous times as well. Even in the year 2013, the issue of race continues to vex the American nation. Yesterday, the United States Supreme Court handed down a 7-1 decision that sent a major affirmative action case back to the lower courts. The Supreme Court effectively handed down what we might call a non-decision, saying that the lower court had mishandled the case and needed to hear it once again. For now, at least, this non-decision by the Supreme Court let stand an affirmative action program at the University of Texas at Austin. That very competitive state university, one of the most competitive state universities in the nation, accepts the very top students from most Texas high schools. After that, it distributes applicant entries according to a race-conscious affirmative action plan. There have been challenges to that plan, and at least many assume those challenges might well be successful. The reason for that is very clear. When affirmative action plans were put into effect back in the 1960s and especially in the 1970s, the major goal was to increase the presence and involvement of African Americans within the American college and university system, especially the most prestigious and competitive universities. And yet now, the racial and ethnic situation in America is quite different from that of the 1970s. The racial and ethnic composition of America is changing fast. Soon America will be a no-majority nation, in which virtually everyone will be a part of a racial or ethnic minority. Hispanics will outnumber African Americans in the American future, and that puts the racial situation in terms of affirmative action very much into flux. Furthermore, the reality is that the greatest challenge to diversity on the American college campus is ideological and economic, not so much racial. That is to say that the greatest distinction that is found in America's private and especially elite public universities is the lack of persons from middle class and from lower income families. That is a far more significant situation of disparity than the current racial makeup of those university cultures. Furthermore, the very idea of affirmative action rankles most Americans, who understand the need to do everything possible to help those who are disadvantaged, but who understand that the kind of bureaucratic systems and legal constructs that are put into place to serve what is called as affirmative action actually disadvantage many people, underserve those who are attempted to be served, and often use very false criteria to understand how exactly to help persons and to construct something like the entering class at a university like the University of Texas. In a fallen world, justice, equity, and fairness are very difficult to achieve. Affirmative action programs were put together and put in place by well-intended political leaders who thought that justice and equity would be best served by putting those programs in place. It is becoming increasingly clear, on the one hand, that such programs cannot possibly fit the complex situation of America in the present. Furthermore, regardless of intent, the actual result of many of these affirmative action programs has not been, to put it bluntly, very affirmative. Meanwhile, this non-decision on the part of the U.S. Supreme Court, an unusual 7-1 non-decision, indicates that traditional affirmative action programs, and even affirmative action programs like that currently in place at the University of Texas, are almost surely on borrowed time. Shifting the scene to Europe, a shocking verdict was handed down from a court in Milan, Italy yesterday when former Italian Prime Minister Silvio Berlusconi was convicted of sex crimes, including having sex with a minor, and sentenced to 7 years in prison. His attorneys had claimed that he could not be convicted on the facts, and Berlusconi claimed the same thing in a posting, of all places, at Facebook. Silvio Berlusconi has been for years one of the most colorful, to say the least, politicians in Europe. Italy, which has gone through a succession of governments rising and falling even since World War II, has had a particularly tumultuous political history. Silvio Berlusconi, a capitalist, a media magnate who has been accused of all kinds of crimes, he has been at the center of it for decades. He is assumed now to be holding on to his seat in Parliament primarily so that he can hold on to a criminal immunity that goes with his seat in the Italian Parliament. One of the interesting aspects about this trial is that Silvio Berlusconi never denied that he actually was engaged in illicit sexual activities, even with this particular woman. He just claimed that he did not know that she was a minor at the time. Furthermore, Silvio Berlusconi, along with many other European political leaders, have been serially and repeatedly involved in this kind of sex scandal. Two things appear to have brought down Silvio Berlusconi in this case. The first was the fact that this scandal involved a minor, an underage girl. But the second thing might actually be more significant, at least in terms of the verdict and the sentence handed down. All of the judges in this particular trial were women. The judges actually sentenced Silvio Berlusconi to more years in prison than prosecutors had even asked for. In other words, even though Silvio Berlusconi said he was confused about the nature of what he had done and whether it was a crime, and even when prosecutors acted as if they weren't really sure how important or urgent the case was, these women judges said, "Oh, we understand it full well. Silvio Berlusconi goes to jail." Back to the United States, the issue of surrogate parenting is back in the news. In this case, it appears in the pages of National Review magazine, where the magazine congratulates two governors in the United States for taking action to veto laws that would have made it much easier to contract for gestational surrogacy. As the magazine explains, gestational surrogacy is the process whereby an embryo conceived in vitro is planted in the womb of a woman who has come up with a contract with one or both of the child's genetic parents. As is said, this holds out hope for many couples who otherwise would not be blessed with children in their own bloodlines. Now, let's also point out that surrogacy covers a larger range of contracts even than this. The surrogacy contract could, outside the purview of the magazine in this case, involve people who have no genetic relationship to the embryo whatsoever. For instance, two gay men could conceivably contract with a surrogate mother to carry an embryo that was purchased in the reproductive technology market. That also would be a surrogacy contract. But regardless of those particulars, National Review magazine is exactly right when it says that such a transaction is very disturbing. As the magazine summarizes, a woman rents out her womb and hands over a child for money. It turns out that the nation of India is the world's largest supplier of what are known as gestational carriers, but the United States ranks second. As the magazine reports, New Jersey Governor Chris Christie last month vetoed a bill that would have made gestational surrogacy much easier to contract for in the law. Just last week, Louisiana Governor Bobby Jindal did the same thing, vetoing a law that would have made it even easier to contract for gestational surrogacy. We're living, as many in all parts of the world have pointed out, in the wild, wild west of reproductive technologies. Even though the nation of India may have more gestational carriers under contract than does the United States, we rank second, and in many other aspects of reproductive technologies, we rank first. And we rank almost non-existent in terms of laws and a structure of regulations to bring order and moral sanity to this whole picture. Congratulations and thanks to two governors, Chris Christie and Bobby Jindal, who at the very least kept matters from getting worse. Sometimes, perhaps the most important thing a political leader can do is stop something from getting worse. Thanks for listening to The Briefing. For more information, go to my website at albertmoeller.com. You can follow me on Twitter by going to twitter.com/Albert Moeller. For information on the Southern Baptist Theological Seminary, go to sbts.edu. For information on Boyce College, just go to boycecollege.com. I'm speaking to you from San Saba, Texas, right on the banks of the San Saba River. And I'll meet you again tomorrow for The Briefing.